Hey guys, welcome to the show, and I hope you guys are ready for today, because normally I do these shows alone. Normally I do my wrestling nostalgia shows solo, but today we bring on Anthony DeMarco to discuss one of the most underappreciated and maybe unknown main events of WrestleMania, one of the greatest main events of WrestleMania at WrestleMania 20. And yes, that main event did include Chris Benoit, but we're looking at this through the lens of purely a wrestling perspective. And we touch on, of course, some current events, our frustrations with the Becky Lynch character at the end, just some of the current events going on with Braun Strowman and Bray Wyatt. But the main focus of this show is WrestleMania 20 in the main event. So I think you guys are going to enjoy this one. It's great to have Anthony back on the show. So I hope you guys are ready. We're going to get it all started right after this. Hey guys, not because you need to, but because you would want to, improve your weight room and bedroom performance with the all-new VasoFlux for Men. It's a natural dietary supplement. This unique blend of barks, roots, herbs, and vitamins is nature's way of keeping you in the game, and for under $10, you can order yours today. Just visit Youth Fountain Laboratory at youthfountainlab.com. That's Youth Fountain Lab, all one word, .com, or call 1-800-853-7856. That's 1-800-853-7856.
It's time for your weekly fix of wrestling nostalgia when we look at wrestling's past eras from the Attitude Era to the Reality Era.
I'd like to think that maybe this company will be better after Vince McMahon's dead. But the fact is, it's going to get taken over by his idiotic daughter and his doofus son-in-law and the rest of his stupid family.
To today. Here on the WWE Podcast.
Welcome, guys, to the WWE Podcast. As mentioned at the top of the show, this is your wrestling nostalgia night. Tonight, it's WrestleMania 20. We're going back to 2004 at Madison Square Garden, where yours truly was in attendance. And that was a luscious 16 years ago. Crazy that is 16 years ago. So my 19-year-old self was in attendance. And so watching this match back, with the main event being HBK versus Triple H versus Chris Benoit for the World Heavyweight Championship, I looked at it through a different lens at 35 years old than I did at 19. But I certainly still remember those moments that I was in attendance for. I remember watching Chris Benoit and remember watching Eddie Guerrero embrace at the end of that match. An iconic moment in wrestling history. And so while my 19-year-old self was a much different version than the 35-year-old me currently as we speak, I was able to pull and share some of those in-person memories and thoughts and feelings throughout the nostalgia episode here. So strap in. I got Anthony DeMarco with me as we went through the match itself, but touched on a lot of the other pieces of the card that are underappreciated, with John Cena and The Big Show for the United States Championship, Undertaker coming back as the Dead Man versus Kane, right? And so there were other big names on this card, other big programs going on. And yes, it is stained by Goldberg-Lesnar. We all know the story, and I'm guilty of it. I admitted it during the conversation that I'm guilty of associating and really staining WrestleMania 20 with how awful that match is. We all knee-jerk reaction to WrestleMania 20 by going, "Ugh, Goldberg-Lesnar. Ugh, Goldberg-Lesnar. That was awful." And it was god-awful. But I don't think we need to brush everything else under the rug and throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, just because we had one bad match, as just awful and terrible and putrid as it was, to dismiss the rest of the card. I don't think that's fair. So we did discuss some of the card, but the main focus of this show was to, of course, give you guys a nostalgic look back at what we thought about this match. And if you haven't seen it, please go see it. You need to see this match and how damn good it was. So check it out. It's WrestleMania 20, the main event. We also touched on some of the current events. I can't have him on without asking about what he thinks about what's going on. And, you know, we did come up with a lot of positives. And so we get to those and we do criticize, as many wrestling fans do. It's like our birthright, right? It's a birthright of wrestling fans to criticize the product. But you know what? At least I do it out of love. I really do. It's because I'm passionate about the product. I know it can be better. And when I see something that stinks, I'm going to call it out, because I don't think that having a product that I like stink should stink. So we're going to get to all of that in just a minute. But first, if you haven't followed me yet, what are you doing? Go follow me on Twitter so you can tell me how much you love the show, or how I can improve it, right? At the WWE Podcast. My email is realwwepodcast@gmail.com. And on a side note, Zelina Vega says she loves us. I'm not kidding. She did say that she loves our show. So thank you to all the co-hosts and everyone that listens. She did get wind of the show. I did compliment her in the past few shows, which I'm sure got her attention. But if you're listening, Zelina, thanks. We love you too. And we would love to have you on the show, right? I mean, if you want to come on and quickly talk about your career, we'd love to have you on as long as time would permit for you. Consider this an official invitation if you're listening. So that'd be really awesome to have her on the show. Again, you guys know I basically spent the majority of my last few shows praising her and her work. And it's not that I haven't noticed it over, you know, prior to these last few weeks where she's gotten much, much more TV time. I've always been a big proponent of her, but it has really come to light over the last few weeks of how good she can be and where I think she can go if given the opportunity of not just being a manager, but eventually being a women's champion. So I won't go into that boat again, because I literally spent like probably an hour straight in total talking about Zelina Vega and all the good she's done on Raw and how big of a bright spot she is on that show. So if you want to go listen to that, you can do that on my last show with the Raw review, which I published last night. And then obviously on the flagship show that we have on Saturdays of the Weekend Review. So go check those out. And Zelina, you're welcome anytime on the show. I think it would be an honor to have you on and to really just chat about your current career and maybe where you want to go or anything else that you would want to talk about. So, okay, moving on to wrestling nostalgia. Let's not wait any longer. Let's get to Anthony DeMarco and myself discussing a little bit of the current product, a couple of tangents along the way, as to be expected. Anybody that talks wrestling knows how easy it is to get on tangents. And so we have a couple of those, but the majority is focused around WrestleMania 20 and the main event of WrestleMania 20. So I hope you guys enjoy this. Again, my schedule is I'll be back on Saturday with Ashley as we do the Weekend Review, look at SmackDown, Raw. And then on Thursday and Friday, of course, tomorrow and Friday will be your AEW NXT reviews. So you've still got three more shows coming to you this week. So, all right, guys, let's get to it. Thank you for listening. As always, I'll talk to you soon. Welcome to your Wednesday edition of the Wrestling Nostalgia Show. And normally I do these shows solo. Normally it's me sitting here going through the matches in my mind, the times in my mind that I long for of the golden age of wrestling that we all, most of us, look back at as the Attitude Era, with the exceptions of Ruthless Aggression, depending on when you grew up. But today I've got a guest, and you know him, Anthony DeMarco, who's back to discuss with me a very controversial match. And I don't say controversial in the quality, but the particular participant in the match. So that being Chris Benoit, as we look at the main event for WrestleMania 20. Anthony, welcome back to the show. Hope everything's going well up there with the whole pandemic going on, and we'll get back to our normal lives as soon as possible.
Yeah, hopefully it's sooner rather than later, but hopefully we can just take everyone's attention away in a positive manner for the next hour or so and put them back in the time machine and go back to what is, in my mind, one of the most underrated Mania main events ever.
It is one of the most underrated, and I think it's one of the most underrated because it's very rarely talked about by WWE. They still have it on their network, but the fact is that they would not want to bring this to light, given that Chris Benoit was involved in this main event and won the main event. So with, and understandably, they're distancing themselves as much as possible from Chris Benoit. So I get why they would do this. And that's probably why we look at it and feel it's underappreciated, because of the participant. So, Anthony, before we get into this though, and we're going to dive into this main event. And as I watched this match, I drew many parallels. Well, I shouldn't say many. Two. I actually have two written down, parallels that are to today's product and really last year's products with some certain things. And so I'll dive into that. And obviously, I'm sure that you have a lot to say on this. But let's quickly talk about what's going on in WWE right now. Obviously, we still have the no fans in attendance rule. That's, from everything I'm hearing, going to be going on for the next several months. I'm hearing July, maybe August, so maybe by SummerSlam time we could have fans back in attendance. That's the timetable I'm hearing now. Again, things change day to day. But as far as the overall product is going, what are some of the good and bad things right now that you're seeing?
Well, the good thing is that I like what they've done so far with Drew McIntyre. I like that they've really kind of just let him be himself. Like, it seems like they took the shackles off of him bit by bit heading into the winter. And now ever since he's become champion, they're really full steam ahead with making him look like a beast. Like, I think that they could have done better with who his most recent opponents are. Like, running through Andrade and his clan, like, I don't think it was probably the smart move for him to bury the United States champion. Maybe have gone up against, like, a lower quality type heel or with Bobby Lashley or something. And while I like the feud with Seth Rollins, I think that they rushed into it a bit. Like, this is a feud that, in my mind, could have been SummerSlam worthy or Royal Rumble worthy, or hell, even Mania worthy. And I just feel like, kind of like what they did last year with AJ Styles and Seth Rollins, where they rushed into it and then everyone kind of forgot about it. I just think that, like, maybe they could have saved a Seth Rollins, Drew McIntyre type of feud for a bigger main event or a bigger pay-per-view than Money in the Bank directly following McIntyre's win at WrestleMania. Over on the SmackDown side of things, I really like what they're doing with Braun and Bray. I think it's kind of a breath of fresh air about, you know, kind of tackling what happened in the past and drawing on how Braun Strowman came about. And I think that's a forgotten art in WWE of, you know, tying things into past things and into past times, rather. And hell, like, it was a pretty long while ago. Like, we're talking like 4 years since Braun and Bray were together side by side in the Wyatt family. So I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, with Roman Reigns not there, I find SmackDown's been pretty shallow as far as top level talent is concerned. So I like what they've done there. And for the negative, I think it's just what I've seen, what I already kind of touched on with Raw, is that while I like the McIntyre character and he himself has done a great job, I just don't really understand the need to rush Seth Rollins into a feud with him, especially given the fact that Seth Rollins just lost a huge match at Mania. And coming off of a loss, he's next in line to challenge for the world title of the brand. And the guy who beat him, Kevin Owens, hasn't been seen since Mania. So aside from that, I think they've done a good job given the circumstances.
Yeah, you kind of stole my thunder. I mean, that's fine. It's fine. I mean, as far as some of the negatives, to kind of go in reverse, yep, I'm with you on first the McIntyre deal with having them use Andrade, use Zelina Vega as the spokesperson, who I've honestly, like, I have really just praised like crazy on this show over the last few weeks, and having her group with Austin Theory and Angel Garza, and having that group really start to gel, and you're starting to feel that group. And I love Zelina Vega at the helm, and having her on a weekly basis in multiple segments is just, it's awesome. I love watching her talk. I really love her character as a whole. And she's one of the bright spots of Raw for sure. And having this group recently come together, typically when groups start to gel and they come together for the first time, they go on a hot streak. They're typically not, especially with the United States champion involved, brought together to be sacrificial lambs for a higher purpose. And
while I love this group and I love Drew, I'm very conflicted in how I feel about that because I just, like you said, I wish it was just another group or another couple of guys that were used in this role rather than three guys of this caliber. And yeah, I'd even throw Austin Theory in there. For those that haven't seen him before, he has certainly held his own. We haven't heard a peep from him in terms of why he's there, what he's doing, or anything, but his in-ring work is certainly speaking volumes. So that's the one thing I would agree with, and it seems as if they started to shift away from that this past week, thank God, and maybe give this group a little momentum. The Bron Bray thing, yes, I'm looking forward to that as well. I think there's a lot to draw from there, and this could be a very deep program. I'm concerned that they're going to give the belt to Bray and not give Strowman any kind of length with the belt. He seems to be cursed whenever he wins a championship now. He just drops it within a month. He did that same thing with the Intercontinental title and dropped it to Sami Zayn, and then we never heard anything from Sami Zayn and Braun Strowman again. I mean, and there are people missing. Like you said, with Seth Rollins, the guy lost at Mania. Kevin Owens hasn't been seen since. And yet Seth Rollins, after a loss, gets rewarded with a championship match. Not just rewarded with a championship match, but doing the age-old, timeless tradition of how to earn a championship in WWE, of attacking the champion. That's all you have to do. And not only that, but then you have Drew McIntyre offer it up to the guy that attacked him instead of saying, you don't deserve this. I know the fighting champion and all of that is supposed to be what a babyface champion does, but it makes them look stupid for offering up the biggest prize in the game to a guy that attacked him from behind, stomped his face in the mat twice, and he gets rewarded for it. So, again, I love the matchup on paper, but I'm a bit perplexed as to why they're doing it now, too. To me, it does seem SummerSlam worthy. Maybe they're going to go back to Brock as he kind of returns in his SummerSlam Survivor Series Rumble Mania, SummerSlam Survivor Series Rumble Mania type of schedule. So maybe that's what they're going to do, is a rematch. So I'm not a fan of the timing or how they got to this, but I do love the matchup on paper.
Yeah, but it's the same thing that they did last year with AJ Styles and Seth Rollins. I remember as soon as AJ Styles got drafted to Monday Night Raw, where I was actually live for that Superstar Shakeup, everyone said, like, oh, here we go, like, dream match, AJ Styles and Seth Rollins. And in my head, I was saying, like, no, like, wait, like, it should be a higher profile match. Like, they can make a really good build to this. And next thing you know, I think they had a match at Money in the Bank, and then AJ Styles went on to turn heel and battle for the U.S. title for the better part of the rest of the year. And again, like, I'm excited for this match, but I come back to the timing, because look, we know that Drew can't possibly lose the title right away, and Seth Rollins can't lose again. He just came off of arguably his biggest loss in the last calendar year, aside from losing to The Fiend in Saudi Arabia against Kevin Owens. So for me, I think it's pretty obvious that it's going to be a false finish of sorts, and they'll drag this on for a pay-per-view or two longer past Money in the Bank. But hey, like, I mean, the match quality is going to be great, and I just really want them to keep this on Drew for an extended period of time, because I think the last time I was on here, I said that they really could have something with Drew, like a top flight babyface for the better part of the next 5 years with him. And there's just so many other guys, like, great matchups to draw from for Drew when he is champion before they, you know, pull the plug on it. Like, you and I have both talked over text about, like, him versus Aleister Black is, like, a dream matchup for us in, like, the future. So, like, I guess as long as Drew isn't hurt for it, it isn't the end of the world. But at the same time, I just think it could have been like delayed for a bigger setting than just Money in the Bank in front of no fans.
Yeah. Look, I know what they're doing, and they're just moving forward. The show must go on. That's what they believe in. And I understand, and I get that they're putting out the best quality product that they can. And they also don't know when they're going to get back in front of fans. So if we say, well, they have to save it, well, that could be a month, 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, hell, maybe longer. I mean, so you can only hold off on this program for so long. But given that they went right to it, tells me that they have a lack of depth on the main the heel side of the roster of Raw, and really the babyface side of top stars. I mean, that just shows you the lack of depth there to go right to Seth Rollins instead of building it. And it's nice to see that Seth has got a piece of his group back this week, and hopefully AOP following suit. I know that an injury was kind of brought down the AOP, but from what I understand, they are on the mend and hopefully will be rejoining Seth, who had this group unceremoniously just disbanded. I mean, he just came out week after week with the Kevin Owens program and just there's no that group just wasn't there. Murphy went away. Maybe he went away with his first name. I don't know. And so AOP also disappeared. And so it's good to see that Murphy is back and taking the lumps for Seth Rollins. So again, I'm looking forward to it. Nobody in this world believes that Seth is going to win, but at the same time, neither guy can afford to lose. Both of them need to keep winning, to, especially on Seth's end, to build back what he lost at Mania. So do you have Seth, like you said, in a false finish? Probably. And they drag this on. But yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I mean, I want to say I'm complaining. I'm really not. I'm just kind of like, I would have loved to have waited. Where most people would say, I want it now, I want it now. Well, you and I know that waiting for something and letting it build and thinking about it in your mind of how they could do it is much more desirable than just doing it all at once. And then you're like, okay, well, now where do you go, right? So I mean, I'm sure many people are out there are going, oh, but that's awesome. They're doing it right now, you know, but not us.
Yeah, I guess we just come from a time when, you know, all WWE did was wait. Like, I was watching the Ruthless Aggression series the other day, and it was about Evolution, and Batista was talking about, like, his build with Triple H to WrestleMania 21, and he was basically saying, like, every week Triple H kept saying, no, you gotta wait for the fans to literally be begging for you to punch me in the face. And, like, if you draw back on that, that build for Batista Triple H, that pretty much started almost in October of 2004 and bled all the way until April at WrestleMania. And that's what kind of just almost builds stars and builds like that actual interest from fans at a pay-per-view. Not these manufactured like main events where like you have like Goldberg versus Roman Reigns for no reason and the build is going to happen over the course of 4 or 5 weeks. Like, that's why I think people really got behind Drew McIntyre versus Brock Lesnar, because it wasn't as long as, let's say, for example, a Batista Triple H, but it was long by today's standards. And I feel like more times than not now, these quote-unquote big dream matches are not built for long enough. It was like when John Cena fought Roman Reigns at No Mercy, what was it, 3 years ago? Mm-hmm. Like, from all accounts, I remember you did a nostalgia. It was a good match, and John Cena may have single-handedly garnered enough intrigue for it with his, you know, promos leading up to it. But that's the type of match where, yeah, you could build that as a dream match, but not over the course of a 3-week build to No Mercy in October.
Exactly. See, that's the thing, and that's hard for some people to conceptualize, is that, yes, everything is pre-planned. We know this. Everything is thought out. Who's going to win is predetermined. What programs they're going to go to next, depending on what long-term is considered today, are thought out, right? They have production meetings and so forth. But the art of being able to make storylines feel organic and feel like that should be the next step, rather than just sitting at a table and manufacturing them, there is such a different feel to it. And being able to execute a storyline that is predetermined, but make it feel like it's not, is not easy to do. It's so simple, but it's not easy to do. So, like you said with Triple H and Batista at WrestleMania 21, I remember that very well. And having Batista week after week and hearing, I remember Batista standing outside the locker room of Evolution when Triple H was talking trash about him, and Batista just stood outside and had a camera watching Batista and just kind of smiling as he the anger built up in Batista, and you were waiting for Batista to turn. And so that is something that is not easy to do, and I remember that very well. And transitioning into our nostalgia, I mean, you had this main event now. I mean, we'll get to the build of it and how it came about and some of the good and bad of it. You had the very organic feel for Chris Benoit, a guy that had come through the ranks 18 or 17 years, however long it had been since he had entered the industry, finally reaching the pinnacle at WrestleMania 20, a guy that builds respect with the fans, a very well-liked guy in the business too. And we're not even going to get to or talk about the outside stuff with Chris Benoit. I mean, I just want people to take that right now and understand that we are separating Chris Benoit, the man, for what he did to his husband and his kid, to the performer, the absolute technician of technicians, people forget how damn good this guy was. And that's what made this story feel very organic. A guy that you're rooting for, a guy that you can relate to, you respect the hell out of. He cut his teeth in front of the fans. It wasn't a Roman Reigns rocket ship. It was a very slow rowboat upstream. And that's, I think, in part of what made Chris Benoit so damn respected and likable, and the rooting for the underdog type of story.
Well, you know, he came over to WWE, I want to say, in late 1999. He showed up in a group called the Radicals with Dean Malenko, Perry Saturn, and Eddie Guerrero. And I remember the first time I saw him, excuse me, was at WrestleMania 2000, WrestleMania 16. And he had a two falls triple threat match with Kurt Angle and Chris Jericho. First fall for the IC title, second fall for the European Championship. And he actually won the Intercontinental Championship. And it was a pretty good opening month debut for him. I remember he main evented a pay-per-view fully loaded with The Rock. He had a good showing there. I believe Shane McMahon was managing him or something for a certain point. But then he kind of dipped for a bit. He had the Mania match with Kurt Angle at 17, but he spent a lot of times like lower ranks. I think he got injured for a couple of years in 2001, 2002 with his neck. And then even when he came back, you know, he was kind of in the tag team scene. He won the tag team titles with Kurt Angle. He tagged a bit with Rhino. And then in 2003, WWE was going through like this transition where they were really looking for the next top flight babyface. You know, they had the big heels in Kurt Angle and Triple H, and Brock Lesnar was still kicking around and was more of a heel by that point in his career. But they were waiting for a big time babyface because they talked about it on the Ruthless Aggression series not too long ago when they aired that, like, The Rock was gone, Steve Austin was gone. Mid 2003, to mid-2004, like that calendar year, they were really searching because John Cena was not a top flight star yet. Same with Batista, same with Randy Orton. WWE was desperately searching for, you know, like a top-ranked babyface. And it kind of paved the way for a guy like Chris Benoit. And I remember how they slowly built this story where Paul Heyman, who was the on-screen GM of SmackDown at the time, made him the number one entrant in the 2004 Royal Rumble, and he went the distance just eliminating the Big Show at the very end. So he had the opportunity. They clearly went with him, and it was crazy to think that, at least in my lifetime, it was the first time I'd ever seen a guy jump from SmackDown to Raw, and that made the storyline so much more interesting for me, how like Paul Heyman, the SmackDown GM, dragged him through the dirt all the way through, forced him to go in at number one. Then he wins the thing, gives SmackDown the middle finger, and jumps boat to Raw.
That is it's a great summation for those that may not fully understand, how, again, very high level, the career of Chris Benoit and how he got to this point. And yes, I do remember that too with the number one entrant and seeing him win. The crowd was behind him the entire time. And, you know, the only fly in the ointment of this story, you have him win the Royal Rumble. He automatically earns an opportunity at the championship, a championship of his choosing, of which he chose Triple H. And so he earns that opportunity and comes out for the contract signing. And I remember Michaels coming out and, you know, he wasn't exactly a fan favorite at this time simply because he was in Chris Benoit's way, and people had seen Triple H versus Shawn Michaels for several years at that point, from SummerSlam 2002, when Shawn Michaels re-debuted and came back in the street fight against Triple H, all the way off and on through 2003, 2004. They had their amazing Last Man Standing match at the Royal Rumble, which, if anybody hasn't seen that, by the way, the Royal Rumble match of 2004, Last Man Standing, Triple H, HBK, you gotta see. It's one of the best I've ever seen. And then it's left at a draw. You get to Mania, and HBK is telling Chris Benoit, I'm this close to finishing what I started with Triple H, and I know this is a big moment for you, but this is something I need to do. And he then proceeds to super kick Chris Benoit and sign the contract that Chris Benoit's name was on. I'm pretty sure, look, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure you can't sign a contract that is that doesn't have your name on it and be legally have it be legally binding. It just doesn't work. It's not an open contract for anyone to sign that the first person to sign it gets an opportunity, right? Like that doesn't work. And it felt a little bit like I felt about Charlotte entering the Ronda Rousey Becky Lynch match that happened at last year's WrestleMania. I said, do they really need them? Does this match really call for HBK? As great as he is, the story was about Chris Benoit. And it told me that not only maybe they thought that HBK didn't have another story that year and this made sense given what happened at the Rumble, but maybe they didn't fully trust didn't trust Chris Benoit to get over with the crowd by winning. And they wanted to basically give that security blanket of HBK being involved. And I don't know which is true. I really don't. Maybe none of that's true, but it felt a little bit like that with, did you get that sense too? Maybe I'm drawing a parallel that doesn't make sense to you, but with the Charlotte entering like last year's main event with the women and HBK entering, really kind of stepping all over Chris Benoit's year.
No, it felt very similar that they were kind of worried about the star power. And let's face it, like the year before the main event was Rock Austin and now you're going to do Triple H Benoit. Like I can understand, you know, the drop off in the star power and you have an HBK in there who has all this back history with Triple H. And then you have all that to play off of. And then you have Chris Benoit. The only thing now, I think the only thing I would say is that, like, it just seemed like creative was different back then. Like, they trusted their top guys more than they had, you know, last year where it was well documented. They didn't think that Becky versus Ronda had enough star power, so they inserted Charlotte. I think maybe they put HBK in there just to make it one more obstacle over for Benoit, because now he's not only going against the top heel in the company, now he's going up against one of the top guys ever in the company. I don't think that storyline-wise, HBK had to be there, but I think it was just how damn good the execution was in the ring as to why I kind of bypassed it and didn't even ever really think about it in a negative manner. I also remember the build being like a lot of like tag team matches involving HBK and Chris Benoit against Evolution, because obviously this was peak Evolution. And on a side note, Evolution had a match at that year's Mania against Rock and Sock Connection, which is honestly, for me, one of the best undercard matches I've ever seen at a WrestleMania, especially given the fact that The Rock came back to pretty much put over Randy Orton and Batista, but that's a topic for another day. But I think it was just that, yeah, the road to this match was a bit bizarre, because I, for one, am not someone who typically enjoys multi-man main events for WrestleMania. I think the one-on-one feel is like no other, and it gives it that actual reality feeling of it. But the way that this match went down and kind of just how it all meshed so well together and how, you know, it just ended, I kind of just, you know, forgot about all maybe the negative thoughts I had about the build and just fell in love with the match. And to this day, I consider it a top three main event in the history of WrestleMania.
You're listening to the WWE Podcast. We'll be right back after this short break.
Hey guys, not because you need to, but because you would want to, improve your weight room and bedroom performance with the all-new VasoFlux for Men. It's a natural dietary supplement. This unique blend of barks, roots, herbs, and vitamins is nature's way of keeping you in the game, and for under $10, you can order yours today. Just visit Youth Fountain Laboratory at youthfountainlab.com. That's youthfountainlab, all one word, .com. Or call 1-800-853-7856. That's 1-800-853-7856.
Welcome back to the WWE Podcast. Let's get back to more great wrestling audio.
It is, and it will never get that recognition because of Chris Benoit, flat out. I mean, there's no simpler way to put it. It's because of Chris Benoit, what he did, that this match will never, ever get the recognition that it deserves, and it's a damn shame. And you are right. The fact that this was forgotten, regardless of any negative build, is a testament to how good this damn match was. And, you know, I only felt that way as I was watching it back with, you know, you got to remember in 2004, I was 19 years old. So my mind at 19 in watching wrestling is a much different mind than 35 watching wrestling and looking at it with a much more analytical eye. So this is just how I felt today as I rewatched this match, that I felt a little bit like, ooh, I've seen this before. But with how good HBK is, this guy is an all-time great, would be put up on a Mount Rushmore of wrestling, I think, in the majority of people's Mount Rushmores of wrestling. He is so damn good. And so, again, with that aside, and I didn't even look at it as a negative in the moment. Today, it brought back bad memories of Charlotte entering the women's main event. But this was a main event that felt very Daniel Bryan before Daniel Bryan was Daniel Bryan. You know, you had a guy who came up through the ranks, scratched and clawed. It was never really billed to be a top guy, but the fans said otherwise, and the fans respect the guy just as they did Daniel Bryan back at WrestleMania 30, and they wanted to go on that journey. And he was involved in a triple threat as well, although he was the one that interjected himself in the one-on-one. Obviously, Chris Benoit is not the one that interjected himself, but the fact is that there's a bit of a parallel there for those that may not know about this match to go back to WrestleMania 30. It's somewhat of a similar story. And the quality of this match, my God, Jim Ross certainly adds a lot to this, as he does anytime he's on the mic. And even Jerry the King Lawler, too. And you know what? It's a night and day situation right now with Jerry the King Lawler of 2020, who I think detracts from the presentation more often than not. And but back when he's paired with JR, these two are a golden team. And having JR screaming at the top of his lungs about Chris Benoit's journey, and it's been 18 years, and, you know, all of that, the ending of it was just fantastic. The pacing, I think it was about 24 minutes long or so. Wasn't too long. Everything about it was fantastic. And for those that love to point to what a five-star match is today, take a look at the pacing of the match at WrestleMania 20 for the main event and tell me which is a better match. Today's, quote, five-star match that has to include 16 suicide dives, 450 splashes, and no selling super kicks as a transitional move. Take a look at this main event and tell me that this main event is not light years ahead of any main event that you've seen in the last 10 years. Because this is a match that is paced nicely. It's not too fast. You can digest it. The story makes sense. There were a lot of near falls. At least that's my taste. I know many people have been acquainted to and have gotten used to today's five-star type of definition of what that is today. But did you notice that too when you take a look back 16 years ago at this main event and go, that's the style. This is the pacing of a match that I like. I don't need 100 miles an hour.
Oh, 150%. I prefer it because I will always remember a point of this match where, you know, HBK and Triple H had just double suplex Benoit through the Spanish announce table, which was like a run-on tradition at Mania at this point in WWE. And I remember there was probably a point of a good 3 minutes, and that's a long time in a wrestling match, where there no moves were made, but because Benoit just got put through the table, HBK was covered in blood wearing the crimson mask, as JR would always say. And HBK was in the ring, face fully covered in blood, and he's looking Triple H dead in the eye. And he's just giving him, like, the signal, like, you know, come on, like, let's get this going. And Triple H is looking right back at him, and JR is almost, like, narrating what each of them are thinking. Basically saying, like, HBK is telling Triple H, like, we got this guy out of the way, like, let's just finish it off. And just, like, he's just telling us the story in an indirect way that we're almost seeing it through Triple H and HBK's eyes. And like, it was so, I don't know how to explain it. It almost gave me goosebumps because, like you said, there was no super kicks, there was no suicide dives, moonsaults, all this. It was a good 3 minutes of the main event of the biggest show of the year where no, quote, moves or high-flying moves were made. It was just two guys looking at each other dead in the eye. And I think, you know, that humanized aspect to it of, like, an actual and intense rivalry, what it could mean. Like, and I feel like those stare-downs are something that I know they still do it, but it just doesn't feel the same. Like, for me, like, the most iconic stare down was, like, WrestleMania 17 when The Rock, like, went on the turnbuckle, flipped the belt off, up, and then, like, he turned and looked at Steve Austin, who was leaning all nonchalant with, like, this shitty-ass grin on his face, like, this shit grin on his face, and they're just looking dead at each other as The Rock's entrance music was still playing. And that's almost, like, a lost art of, like, that actual, like, natural look in a rivalry. And that's what you saw right there. And there's other points in the match where, you know, there was a lot of submissions, like just the finish of the match alone, where like HBK goes for the super kick, Benoit ducks it, throws him out of the ring, then Triple H is waiting for him, goes to pedigree, and then Benoit counters into the crossface. And he had Triple H in that crossface for probably a good minute and a half before Triple H tapped. And there was a point there where you thought Triple H was going to tap, and then Benoit rolled them back into the middle of the ring. Like, it was just so methodical and well thought out. It was wrestling psychology 101. And honestly, for me, it's the best triple threat match I've ever seen.
In an era where triple threat matches, especially for championship matches at this level, were not common. So Austin, who was, I believe, the GM or the sheriff or some kind of authority figure at the time, made the announcement that it was going to be a triple threat match. You know, triple threat matches existed, but they weren't used like they're used on a weekly basis to this. I mean, in 2020 and really from 2010 and forward. This is, you know, not a format that was used very often, much less in a championship match at WrestleMania, a triple threat format. You know, in today's WrestleMania era, in pay-per-view era, we would just go, yeah, it's probably going to be a triple threat with so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And we have to be told, even today, well, there's no advantage for the champion. They don't have to be involved in the decision. I mean, if I hear that one more time, I don't know if it's just trolling the fans at this point that they're telling us the rules of a triple threat, which doesn't even make sense because there's three men that it automatically becomes no DQ. I still don't get that. I guess it's because what are you going to do? Disqualify that one guy and then the match is over just because one guy made the bad decision? I would say, well, then take them out of the match. They're disqualified. They now leave the match. It's a very simple solution. So, yeah, again, the triple threat format was not common. It was very one-on-one heavy for a main event, as it should be, in my opinion. But with these three ring generals who just tore it down and kept the crowd in it after a full night of wrestling, you got to remember, WrestleMania was probably only 3 or 3.5 hours at that time, so it wasn't an 8-hour marathon like it is today, but they were able to keep the crowd invested. I was there live. I remember the energy. I remember that feeling of, and if you listen, the crowd was against HBK. It, you know, if you're going to draw a parallel to the WrestleMania 30 main event, HBK played Batista. And, you know, that is where it came from, was that feeling of Batista, who was supposed to be cheered, ends up getting booed. Randy Orton is the Triple H, if we're going to draw all parallels, and we have Chris Benoit playing Daniel Bryan. So in this case, the people didn't want to see HBK win. This was all about Chris Benoit. The crowd was fully behind Chris Benoit. HBK was getting booed. Wasn't playing a heel necessarily, but he was getting the reaction of, no, 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 we don't want him. We want Chris Benoit, the guy that deserves it, who has been here. He's been the good soldier. And they got their wish. And the ending, as you said, that finish was, I even got chills watching it again. And I knew that Chris Benoit was going to win, but I'm still thinking to myself, is he going to tap? Because he did. There was that moment where he got up in the crossface. He was an inch away from the ropes, and I thought he was either going to pass out or the ref was going to call for the bell. He was going to tap out, and none of that happened. He rolled out, rolled through it, and Benoit held on, and Triple H was bleeding like a stuck pig, and he finally tapped. And then you get the very end of the show, and this is something I'll never forget, probably out of the whole match itself. As great as the match was, for whatever reason, the image that will always stick in my mind being there live was Eddie Guerrero coming out. And Eddie Guerrero standing there and being able to see him, those two embrace. You know, we're all trained, and I was trained at that time as a wrestling fan that, what, is he going to attack Chris Benoit? Is he going to, you know, what's going to happen here? And when they just embraced, it was number one, refreshing, given that they were on parallel paths, obviously, with the whole Radical group, as you mentioned, coming in WWE. For those that didn't follow his WCW career, that's, as we know, where it started in WWE anyway. And having these two embrace at the end of the show was it was heartfelt. It was very, very different from any other ending to WrestleMania. And having two guys that just were on such parallel paths, and to have both men hold their respective championships and embrace was a moment I'll never forget, with the confetti coming down and being there live.
Well, another thing that makes me remember this match so fondly is that WrestleMania 20, at least for me, is a top three WrestleMania of all time. Like, the undercard was just about as good as it gets. What I loved about it, and I'll always think about this, is that except for the Intercontinental Championship, which Randy Orton had, and he was involved in the Evolution versus Rock and Sock match, every championship in WWE was defended. Each tag team titles were defended in fatal four-way matches on Raw and on SmackDown. Both matches were amazing. I'll never forget those. It was some of the best tag team wrestling in those multi-team formats I've ever seen. John Cena won the U.S. title against the Big Show. Victoria fought Molly Holly in the hair match, and she actually shaved Molly Holly bald at the end. Eddie Guerrero defended the WWE Championship against Kurt Angle. And the Cruiserweight Championship had like a gauntlet match or Cruiserweight Turmoil, something along those lines. And it was just a way that I felt as though, WWE tries to do this today a lot, where they try and get everyone on the card, but they did it in a way at this year's Mania where it felt like it wasn't just like a participation badge for everyone in. Like, they made every title match feel important, or like the way they were able to get like Batista in the tag team match or stuff like that. And even the undercard matches were great, the non-title ones. Like, I remember Christian and Jericho had this really like intense personal match where like Trish Stratus actually turned heel and ended up with Christian by the end of it. You had Kane versus Undertaker part two, where Undertaker came back and gave a rebirth to the Dead Man character. Like, pretty much every match except for the infamous Goldberg-Lesnar match, they hit it out of the park. And so oftentimes when you have these amazing undercards, it really sets the stage for the main event to be received in a tough fashion. Like, I think the perfect example was 2 years before this match of Jericho and Triple H following up on Rock versus Hogan. And for HBK, Triple H, and Benoit to come out and put on a match as they did with the crowd invested as they were, it just tells you something. And then culminating it with Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero, who were pretty much being ushered in as it was short-lived their times at their respectively at the top of SmackDown and Raw respectively, but at that point in time they were the top two babyfaces in the company, and they culminated one of the best Manias of all time.
You know, the thing is, when people look at WrestleMania 20, and I'm guilty of this too, when I hear the words WrestleMania 20, unfortunately, the first thing that comes to my mind and most people's minds, the terrible Goldberg-Brock Lesnar match. And I don't know if it's a reflex that we all are sometimes driven towards negativity. I don't know if it's just that this is the only match that WWE isn't shying away from. As terrible as it was, they actually brought it up during the Goldberg and Brock Lesnar story. I remember them bringing footage of it in. I don't know why we just look at WrestleMania 20 and go, oh, that was so terrible, Goldberg and Lesnar. But damn, look at the rest of the card, like you said. You have John Cena defeating Big Show in the very first match of the night. I remember standing there going, man, I love this John Cena guy. He was just such a breath of fresh air. He had come in 2 years earlier. Obviously, we all know the infamous Kurt Angle Ruthless Aggression segment, and beat the Big Show in about 9 minutes. And it was seeing him do the FU, as it was called then, not the Attitude Adjustment. It was still okay to say those two letters together. He wins the United States Championship, and really, I think that put him on the map. And we all know that the rest is history with John Cena. And, I mean, you said it. Eddie Guerrero and Kurt Angle put on a clinic. And I remember that match extremely well. And I think people forget just how good Eddie Guerrero was at playing with your emotions. I think Guerrero and Benoit are, on a wrestling sense, Benoit may be more intense, but Guerrero has more of more depth to his personality. And he's able to make you feel such a range of emotions. Guerrero is in my top five. I mean, as far as like performers, all around performers go, it's such a shame he was taken from us so early. I mean, damn. I'm just getting like all choked up thinking about how damn good Eddie Guerrero was. But this whole card from top to bottom, if you take out that middle match of Goldberg and Lesnar, it was a damn good card. I mean, like you said, you had Rock and Sock Connection against Evolution. You had, Victoria and Molly Holly. And then you had Undertaker defeating Kane and coming back as the Dead Man for the first time in, what, 2-3 years? And people were clamoring for that and building and building. And nobody saw the Undertaker until WrestleMania. They didn't do any silly stuff with Raw beforehand. They hinted that he was coming back as the Dead Man, but you didn't know for total sure until maybe you heard the gong at the Rumble, which, my God, if you ever hear that pop, I might have brought that up with you. If anybody wants to hear a pop for just a momentary pop in the Rumble that they've never heard before, just YouTube Undertaker's gong at the Rumble.
For a single sound.
It was seriously, it was the loudest pop I've ever heard for a single sound. It was unbelievable, which that should have been a big clue. It's going to be the Dead Man and not the American Badass. But when Paul Bearer came out, and I will never forget it, like standing there and chills running down my body and hearing the, oh, yes. And knowing Paul Bearer was there really put icing on the cake. And Kane still not believing. I mean, I remember him standing there going incessantly, like, you're not real, you're not real. And Undertaker winning was, I mean, I know we're not talking about that match, but I'm given some memories of actually being there live. But yes, to your point, this card is so underappreciated. It's not even funny. And it's unfortunately stained very badly by just epically bad how bad Goldberg Lesnar was, and the fact that Chris Benoit was in the main event and won the main event certainly doesn't help that, and WWE does their best to suppress this whole pay-per-view, unfortunately with good reason.
Well, because for me, like I said when I first started with you, like I really started watching wrestling at WrestleMania 2000. So like when I give like my top WrestleManias of all time, I talk about from 16 on. Because anything before that is just me watching on replay, where I didn't really have any context for any of the matches. But for me, aside from 17, this is the best WrestleMania of all time. Like, obviously, there are some very other good WrestleManias. Like, I've always liked 23, where that we already did a nostalgia for that HBK versus John Cena. I really liked 31, to be honest. I found that was an excellent WrestleMania. WrestleMania 18... You know, you kind of have to put it in there because of The Rock and Hogan and just how iconic that match was. But to be quite honest, I rewatched it the other day. And besides that, it was kind of garbage. And I always just will think of what a missed opportunity they had where they used Triple H versus Jericho. And I have no idea why they didn't do Triple H versus Stone Cold Steve Austin in the main event of Mania. You know, those two never had like a top flight feud. Well, they did, but nothing that ever culminated at a major pay-per-view. They did Triple H and Rock and Austin, but they never did Austin and Triple H. And considering that they threw Austin away in like a no-nothing match with Scott Hall, that always perplexes me that the main event wasn't Austin Triple H. But nevertheless, I just think WrestleMania 20, for the reason of Chris Benoit, you know, being the lasting image of the show, and Brock versus Goldberg, people aren't really well informed on just how great that pay-per-view match was, on that, how good that pay-per-view was as a whole. Like, I remember just the Fatal 4-Way Tag Team matches. Like, I remember Booker T and RVD won it on the side of the Raw for the Raw Tag Team, and on the SmackDown side, it was Rikishi and Scotty Too Hotty. And not to say that those matches stole the show in either way, but I just remember just the ring psychology of those Fatal 4-Way Tag Team matches. You know, like being excited for so many tag team matches on a card and all of them being so good. I don't know. It's just, and for me, this was almost like peak Ruthless Aggression era. Because, yeah, Ruthless Aggression era started in late 2002, so it was kind of in full effect by WrestleMania 19. But at WrestleMania 19, you still had the leftover from the old era. You know, Vince versus Hulk Hogan was one of the main events. Rock versus Austin was one of the main events. So it was Ruthless Aggression, but there was still a lot of carryover from the Attitude Era. But this year, where you had Benoit walking out as the Raw World Champion, Eddie Guerrero walking out as the SmackDown World Champion, Randy Orton and Batista going over on Rock and Saw Connection, John Cena winning his first title in WWE, for me, it was just like, you know, we've been pushing this era for the better part of 2 years, but now this is the culmination. These are the faces of the future that you guys better get accustomed to, as they all went over on Stars of the Past.
That's a good way to put it, too, is that this was a turning point in WWE from a talent perspective of what direction they're going, right? This was, like you said, it's no longer the Attitude Era. The Ruthless Aggression Era, you could argue, peaked here. Certainly, it technically, from a standpoint of when did the PG era start, which is in 2008, the Ruthless Aggression technically went from 2002 to 2008. But yeah, you could say it culminated here and went on a slow downslide until 2008. But you know, this was a pay-per-view that really, I think, defined and turned the page of where WWE was going. They were no longer going with Triple H or HBK as champion, that, you know, the usual suspects, if you will, of you know, those normal guys that just kind of like play hot potato with the belt of, okay, my turn, your turn, my turn. It's a different guy, a respected guy that they trusted to lead the company. And Chris Benoit was, you know, he obviously, we talked about his in-ring prowess, but on the mic, he was never an A-plus promo. But with him, his promo ability was short and sweet, but not short and sweet in a way that Roman Reigns would be short and sweet. He would talk in a way that made you believe him, even if he didn't speak a lot. Like, he would be very believable in what his few words would say. It wouldn't just feel very scripted or very cute or just a, you know, a punchline that they like to draw up for Roman Reigns. And I'm using him as an example because promos aren't exactly Roman's strengths. So with Chris, he never ever had that long A-plus go-home promo, but he never needed to. Chris was, when he needed to, he would speak and he would be intense and you'd believe him and he would catch your attention. But his in-ring ability, his ability to tell a story, his snugness, you couldn't see through his work. He brought you in. He was stiff but safe in the ring. He was so good at it and such a technician that it almost didn't matter that he was so good on the mic because of how good he was in the ring. And, you know, I always say that the top guy has to be an A-plus promo, or at least very good on the mic to be able to cut that great promo to make an audience feel. In this case, Chris is so good, I may go back and say he's the exception to that rule.
Well, look, this was the first and last world title he ever won. And even if that tragedy wouldn't have happened, I'm not convinced that he would have ever gotten back to this height. At the end of the day, I don't think that Benoit was, as the authority would put it, an A player. He was probably a B-plus player because of that, not because of his in-ring or his skill or his size. I think it was just because his character lacked just a little bit of depth. And on the mic, it was somewhat hard to, you know, get behind him because he was very, you know, just, I don't know, direct. I don't know, rough around the edges, if you will. But at the end of the day, I'm still happy we got to see it. And, you know, it culminated losing the world title to Randy Orton at SummerSlam, and he never won it again. But he was always, I would say, an upper mid-card guy who just scratched the surface of, like, a main event player. And at the end of the day, he probably proved to be just that. But because of just how great he was in the ring, like, what other wrestler had two finishing moves that were both submissions? Like, yeah, he had the flying headbutt and, like, infinity and the trifecta of the German suplexes, but that was more of kind of like a signature. His two, like, finishers were the crossface and the sharpshooter. He was just such a technical guy from an older era. And, you know, looking back on it today, like, now it's more, he wouldn't almost, like, I don't know how to even compare it to today, where you get guys like Ricochet who are bouncing off the ring like a ricochet. But to relate it back to Benoit, who was such a technician and a grappler and so, like, ground-based, like, I guess maybe I've grown a greater appreciation for him because of what we've been accustomed to in the modern day. But I just always appreciated Benoit for what he achieved after being such a mid-card guy for the majority of his career.
Yep, he was. I mean, like you said, he had the belt for 6 months, and that is, well, not even 6 months. But typically, if you're going to have a win at WrestleMania, I've been of the belief that you hold it through at least SummerSlam to make that championship win mean something, to make it stick. And that's just been my belief, because WrestleMania to me are always turning points. Whether you want them to be or not, they are the next chapter of WWE. You want whoever you anoint at Mania to have some staying power, give them a real shot at getting over, and see what they can do, and give them till SummerSlam. To me, that's always been the start and end date. It doesn't have to be at SummerSlam, but minimum at SummerSlam have always been, like, that's what I'm thinking. And you can go beyond that. I mean, we were seeing Becky Lynch's, you know, just crazy long run now that people are starting to get extremely antsy about. Oh. And maybe we'll touch on that before we head out here. But so putting that aside for a moment, the fact is that I like these matches, these outcomes, to have meaning, to have something that the person winning can take the ball and run with, or the person that lost sulk in their sorrows and start from the bottom again. The WrestleMania has always been the culmination of that. At least that's my thinking. That's how I feel WrestleMania should be structured. It's the end all be all. It is the culmination of a year's worth of work to get these guys and gals here and to see what they can do and showcase their talent and put the best of the best there. And you said there is no participation award here. I mean, but when you look at the women's side here, I mean, you got to remember, this is 16 years ago with WWE. But you quickly mentioned, with Tori and Sable defeating Miss Jackie and Stacy Keibler in a Playboy evening gown match. I mean, imagine WWE in today's era trying to sell that as a women's match. There would be protests. People would, you know, the hashtag cancel WWE Network would be trending number one. The media would pick it up. I mean, but you have to remember too, like, I don't know why we're celebrating WWE for being behind about 30, 40, 50 years in women's rights and how they should be portrayed. And yet, you know, only was, what, 5-6 years ago that WWE was almost forced. Their hand was forced by the hashtag Give Divas a Chance to take women seriously, and we want real women's wrestling. It wasn't WWE on their own doing this. It had to be the fans who said, yeah, this isn't right. We want to see something beyond bra and panties matches, but I digress.
Yeah, it was just such a different time. Like, I was watching WrestleMania 19 about a month ago, and they had, like, the Miller, like, catfight girls, pillow fight match. But, yeah, I just, before we close out here, I actually wanted to touch on something that you brought up. I believe it was last week in Nostalgia, about The Rock versus Roman Reigns rumor. And I just wanted to give my opinion on it, because The Rock is my favorite wrestler of all time, and I love when he comes back, or at least I did, because I felt as though when The Rock comes back now, he doesn't play The Rock. He plays Dwayne Johnson. And for me, it's just like, you've got to have the sunglasses at the bare minimum if you come back to play The Rock. And for me, it kind of bothers because I don't want the guy, like, yeah, Dwayne Johnson, the man, is great, and he's done, you know, he's as big as a Hollywood success as there can be, and he seems like a great guy, but I didn't fall in love with Dwayne Johnson, you know, like, we all fell in love with the character The Rock, and when he comes back, the most recently on the premiere of SmackDown on Fox, he didn't play The Rock, and then I heard this rumor coming about Roman Reigns and whatnot, and I originally got excited because, you know, first reaction to The Rock coming back to wrestling is to get excited. But for me, I just got kind of like annoyed almost because I said they're going to bring – if this does happen, The Rock is going to come back. He's going to be Dwayne Johnson. He's not going to be The Rock. And they're going to have a babyface versus babyface match. And it's probably going to end like the way WrestleMania 29 did, with The Rock holding up John Cena's arm and pointing to him. And in my head, I know that's exactly what it would be, but insert Roman Reigns in place of John Cena. So I guess you already gave your opinion on it, that like in theory you want to see it, but at the same time you don't because you know the avenue that would go down. But like, do you think that's what it would be, or do you think they could possibly take another approach to this match if it were to happen?
I don't see a way in which, assuming this is just a one-off, right? This is not going to be a multi-pay-per-view program, okay? Because that would possibly lead us down another road. Assuming this is a one-off and they just build to that one match and then it's over and Rock goes back to Hollywood and Roman Reigns goes back to, you know, weekly television. So assuming that, because that's big, then I don't see another way in which The Rock doesn't lose, because Roman Reigns is still going to be there the following Monday night. The Rock's going back to Hollywood. I mean, John Cena famously said this in his promo. You know, I don't have another chance. I don't have something to fall back on. If I lose this match against you, you're going to be sitting on a beach with a margarita, you know, reading your movie script while I'm here on Monday Night Raw. And that's exactly what's going to happen with Roman Reigns and The Rock if they do indeed end up having a match at WrestleMania. Again, very speculative, but it seems to have run the rumor mill as of late. And having this match happen, if it happens, there's just no other way to do this other than having the WWE try to use The Rock to endorse Roman Reigns and give him the stamp of approval of one of the greatest of all time. But they've already tried that, right? They tried that at the Royal Rumble in 2015, and famously, hilariously, if I feel bad, I watch this Royal Rumble where they booed the hell out of not just Roman Reigns, but even The Rock there didn't help. So if they try to go to that well again 5 years later, or 6 years later, as it will be soon, I don't think it's going to work. I think it's going to blow up in their face if they try to present babyface versus babyface. If they do, and all they have to do, and I say this so easily and simply, is turn Roman heel. And if he wins against The Rock, at least he's a heel and he can, you know, take that win and never stop reminding us about it and shove it in our face. That's how you get Roman to win and have it make sense and have it not backfire and be a really a negative for what they're trying to do, is ultimately make Roman Reigns the face of the company, make him the next guy, the next Cena, the next Austin, the next Rock. That's what they're trying to do with Roman. They've been trying to do this since the whole Shield really disbanded back in 2014 or whatever it was. So to me, if I would have The Rock win, but having The Rock win and then go away doesn't do a whole lot for Roman Reigns, who's going to be there week in and week out. So to me, have The Rock lose, but have Roman be the heel, and which I think the ultimate way to do that is to have it at WrestleMania, which the fans would boo Roman Reigns anyway. So that's the only way I would think about it to do.
Do you get the feeling, as I just brought up, that when The Rock comes back now, he almost doesn't even play The Rock anymore?
Yep, that's exactly. He's like a guy trying to play The Rock. He doesn't feel like The Rock anymore. And, you know, some people would say, well, that's just the evolution of a character. No, I mean, that's not. I mean, there are evolutions of characters that feel organic, that feel like it's the right thing to do next. And to evolve is to adapt, which means you're able to stay relevant. In this case, it's Dwayne Johnson who tries to play The Rock. And that's, I don't know how to, I know exactly what you're saying. I just don't know how to articulate to people that are listening of what I'm saying. We all know Dwayne Johnson is The Rock, but The Rock is the character that got Dwayne Johnson on the map. That's just a fact. So when Dwayne Johnson comes back and tries to play The Rock, it's very apparent he's trying to play The Rock, but also kind of wink and nod at it, not fully invest in that character and fall back on Dwayne Johnson as himself. It's a hard thing to explain, but I know exactly what you're saying. He doesn't feel like the true all-in Rock. He feels like I'm kind of one toe into The Rock, one toe into Dwayne Johnson. I kind of straddle the line. I throw out my catchphrases. But when I'm speaking, I'm not fully invested in The Rock. Like you said, the character, how he dresses, I totally see it. I just don't know how to explain it better. I'm not smart enough to articulate it beyond that.
Yeah, well, for me, it's like, unless you're in a match, The Rock should always have sunglasses on. And I remember when he first came back in 2011, he played The Rock and he had that 25-long-minute promo to end Raw where he made fun of Michael Cole and John Cena. But there was a point where he said, I want to tell you guys something as Dwayne. And he takes off his sunglasses and he speaks from the heart to the crowd. And then when he was done, he put the sunglasses back on and he said something along the lines of just like, plain and simple, The Rock is back. Something along those lines. And it's like, you know, man, like if you're going to come back and, you know, almost grace us with your presence, for lack of a better term, can you come back and just do it with the part that people want to see? Like, at least for me, like, I don't want you to come back and, like, be smiling and wearing your Under Armour gear that you're trying to promote. I want you to come back with sunglasses on, with an oversized Gucci shirt and a chain. Like, I don't know, that's, and I don't want you smiling all the time, and I want you to talk in the third person, and, like, I don't know, it's, like you said, like, he is The Rock because he has the catchphrases and he has the comedy aspect to it, but, like, it's like it was more back when he was The Rock. It was a dry comedy that he was able to just keep a straight face the whole time with the sunglasses and the outfits that he would wear. But now it's just like he comes out and like you said, it's like it's almost like he's being himself writing off of a script that he wrote 15, 20 years ago.
He's like a parody of himself. I don't know how to explain it. Again, I always love to see him. But you know you're gonna get a watered down version of what we remember. And I'm sure if we were able to talk to him, he would say, well, I can't be that guy anymore because that's not who I am anymore. The character can't live in the past, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I could hear the reasoning for it. But the fact is that it's, you know, it is 2020. You can't have him coming out there in 1999 gear. It would feel a bit comedic, I think. Some people would look at it as almost a comedy act that he's still trying to live in the past, and characters do evolve, and I get it, but I think it's his level of commitment to that character and to protection of that character that when he comes back, he's more worried about being Dwayne than about truly being The Rock. And that segment he did with Michael Cole, I remember it when he was actually invested in doing that promo. It was like The Rock was back. And it felt like an updated version of The Rock that I was accepting. And then he took the sunglasses off, like he went back to being Clark Kent, and then talked to the fans, and then, you know, put sunglasses back on, and he was Superman again. And once you take the sunglasses off and you're Clark Kent, it's hard to undo that and then just put your disbelief aside and go back to the Superman character. I get why he did that. I understand that. Save that stuff for Twitter. Right. I don't know. You and I are just, I guess, of the old school where I just like characters protected. I don't like the business being exposed on its own show.
Yeah, I guess we came from a time when we knew it was scripted, but there was always that level of disbelief of like, oh, shit, was that real? OK, was that real? Maybe that one was real and they let it go. Like, I remember the whole Matt Hardy Edge angle. Where, because for me, like, I think a way that they try and, like, swerve us to thinking it's real is when the commentary stops. Because so oftentimes when something bad does happen, you can tell because the commentary stops. When Jerry Lawler had the heart attack, ironically enough, in Montreal, they didn't do commentary for the rest of the night. And I remember when they were building that Matt Hardy to Edge promo, which ultimately in my mind kind of flopped, but the beginning was just crazy because of how real it was, where Matt Hardy was like invading Raw, coming in through the crowd and attacking Edge. And then he was calling Edge Adam and Lita Amy by their name. But like, we really didn't know because there was no internet and WWE wasn't so willingly transparent that they were quote unquote sports entertainment, that we could like suspend that disbelief. And that's why like The Rock, now when he comes back, it's almost like he's embracing like, yeah, well, I'm actually Dwayne Johnson. Like, hell, his page on the WWE, his profile on WWE.com is Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Like, could we just leave it as The Rock? Like, come on. Like, I don't understand. Like, even, and for the evolving of character things, like, I get that. Like, look, Triple H is not coming out in a leather jacket anymore like he did in 2000. And Steve Austin is, you know, he smiles a whole lot more and he's not who he was. But, like, it seems like an older version of their characters. The Rock, it's like, yeah, he's cocky, but it's almost like a different person. Like, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm so emotionally invested in that character because he was far and away my favorite superstar when I was growing up. But it's just like now, like I get so excited when he comes back. Like when he came back for SmackDown, I was so disappointed. Like, yeah, he had some funny moments, like making fun of Corbin and whatnot. But like just the thing of him, like, you know, broing down with Becky Lynch, which why the hell does she have to insert herself in every legend type of segment now? I really don't understand. But like, if you're going to come back and you're going to come back for what is it, like 10 minutes every 2 years, which is pretty much what it is now, a segment every 2 years, just come back with the sunglasses. And if you want to wear a tracksuit, fine, but just be The Rock. Like, you're an actor for a living. The least you can do is act the part that got you to where you are.
Right. Don't try to pretend you're not acting. Just either go all in or don't. And I see what you're saying. And you briefly touched on Becky Lynch, and I'm scared to even ask you about Becky Lynch right now. And she does seem to be inserting herself in every single Legend segment to try to get the good old rub, as they say, from those stars. And when I was very concerned about the Raw that the 316 day, the very first Raw that was not live in front of an audience, which was a damn shame with Stone Cold there. My God, that was coronavirus couldn't have waited just one more week, right? It could have waited one more damn week where they did, you know, they didn't shut down everything and have Stone Cold get that pop and all that. But anyway, I digress. I was very concerned on that Raw that Becky Lynch was going to stun Stone Cold, because we saw that happen on some kind of WWE special. I remember seeing it, and that would have absolutely set me off. So Becky Lynch right now, as we dive a little bit into her, she's on over a year now as champion. They're trying to, I think, humanize her with video packages. We haven't seen a whole lot or heard a whole lot from her since her win over Shayna Baszler at Mania. You and I are both of the belief of it may be time to turn her heel, because her championship run, I think, was over about 6 months ago in both of our minds, with the arrogance she shows, the goat shirts, the semi trucks with her face painted on it, that apparently we were supposed to believe that she just takes from arena to arena because the camera always gets a clip of her coming out of it and honking the horn like she's a 5 year old. And all these, just a number of things that I'm not even going to get into. You and I have mentioned it many times, of the things that have just turned us off about the babyface character of Lynch. And so what do you think about her reign so far? Do you have any idea when it could possibly end? Just your thoughts in general.
I'm not going to go too far into it because I absolutely despise the character. It's gotten to the point now where it's not even like I want her to be heel heat. It's that I just need a break heat. Like, when I see her, I change the channel or I fast forward. It's gotten to that point. Like, I'll literally just be like, I can't deal with this right now. The monster truck thing for me was the end of it. Like, not only is it not believable, but it's so unnecessary. Like, I don't even know what you're trying to make the character now. Like, I have no idea what the goal is here. I don't get it. It's so stale. It's so weird that, like, they weren't using Becky Lynch this time 2 years ago, and now they've just dragged it out to such an extreme limit on the other side of the spectrum where, like, I could literally go a year without Becky Lynch and I would be content with it. Like, I don't like the fact that they tried to make her Stone Cold 2.0. I don't like the fact that she's inexplicably on, like, great terms with Steve Austin and The Rock. Like, how are they best friends? Like, how does that make any sense? Like, we're just supposed to believe that? Like, it's just so over the top with this, with Becky Lynch. And, like, the championship reign is, like, you know what, fine. If you want to keep the belt on her, like, be my guest. Like, I don't know. Like, it's not even about her being champion. It's just the character. Because I do think that long title reigns are a thing of the past that I would like to see more of. So I can respect that about what WWE is doing with her. But it's just the character of, like, people connected with Becky Lynch because she was relatable. And now she's just as unrelatable as it possibly gets. That, like, honestly, I've been done with Becky Lynch since the summer, and now even more so. It's tough for me to watch, and I don't even watch her segments or matches anymore.
She is getting tougher to watch, and she hasn't been a big part of Raw in a while, and maybe that is WWE realizing they need to give people a break from her if they don't want people to turn on her. Again, they're lucky right now that they don't have a live audience, because I think if they had a live audience, the crowd would make their opinion known very, very vocally. And we would have seen that, especially after WrestleMania and the outcome that happened with Shayna Baszler losing. I would have loved to have heard that Raw after Mania crowd give it to Becky Lynch. I think they would have turned her heel that night. And I think the fans are asking for it, but... like you said, is it a heel heat? I don't know. I mean, you are talking about unlikable characteristics of Becky Lynch, and I agree. I'm probably a notch a little bit below you of changing the channel. I watch it, well, number one, because I have to. I have a podcast. But number two, I am interested to hear what she has to say and to see if she is descending into this darker character of F the fans. I mean, maybe they go that road, maybe they don't. But they seem to be, based on the video packaging this past week, that they're trying to rebuild Becky Lynch as a human being, and they're not trying to turn her heel. And they're sensing that people are getting a little bit stale with her character, and the arrogance that has come out of it, it is very unbecoming of her character. Like you said, it is an issue with her character. It's the arrogance and all this swagger and all of this bravado that is, it's really, really not appealing as a babyface. And she attacks Shayna Baszler from behind. Like, all these things, like, if I put it on a checkbox and I didn't tell you who the name was, you'd go, that's a heel. No, it's Becky Lynch that's just trying to be the anti-hero and take the same formula from Stone Cold and apply it to her character. Doesn't work that way. Stone Cold was a legit badass. Stone Cold drew his own path. Stone Cold was not even in the same stratosphere as you. So I know what they're trying to do. Many people have drawn the parallels that she's a female version of Austin. No, she's not. No, she's not. That's not even a... That's insulting to Stone Cold. And, you know, all due respect to Becky Lynch, she's in a different world than Stone Cold. She's in a different environment. She's in a very PG environment. She is restricted by a lot of things. But the fact is, her character is very unlikable right now. At least the last I remember seeing her, her promos, the way she speaks, the way she walks, it feels very kind of D-bag.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it. I don't want to go any further down the rabbit hole because I don't want to, you know, crap on a character that a vast majority of the fan base likes, but it just hasn't been for me for quite a while right now.
Yeah, good. Thank you. I'm glad you cut me off. Like, you can sense me just getting riled up. That's good. Thank you. So I do need a chaperone sometimes on this show. So, all right. Well, beyond any of that, Anthony, did you have anything else that you wanted to touch on or have any final thoughts on that we didn't talk about?
No, I got it all off my chest, and honestly, I just love going back in the time machine back to this era of wrestling. So it felt good to relive a match that doesn't get as much appreciation as I think that it should.
Agreed, and that is a match that I hope many people that listen to this will go back and watch. And yes, you have to look at it through the lens of forgetting about what Chris Benoit did. Again, we understand, we all know the story inside and out. Unfortunately, it's a tragedy, we know that. But if you look at this from a wrestling perspective, from a psychology perspective, from a storyline perspective, this was one of the best matches at WrestleMania, period. Any WrestleMania in any era, 1 through 36, this one would stack up against almost any of them. And so you're doing yourself a disservice by not watching it. You'll catch yourself up very quickly with the promo packages that are done right before the match. So if you don't know how they arrived and how they and why they did, the promo packages are just classic in early 2000s of the like the Limp Bizkit songs and all that stuff. Like it's just such a it's such a pullback into time. And so you'll enjoy it. I guarantee if you're a wrestling fan, you'll enjoy this match. So, Anthony, before you go, let everyone know, if you want to, of how they can reach you on social media.
You can find me on Twitter at ADeMarco25.
Easy enough. All right. Well, Anthony, I'm glad you could pop on. I know Wednesdays are not our normal times, but these are crazy times. I know our schedules are a little bit fluxed up right now, but we'll get back into it, and maybe we can find a day that works for both of us, and it's great to have you back on.
Yeah, looking forward to it, Matt, and talk soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
Hey, guys. Not because you need to, but because you would want to. Improve your weight room and bedroom performance with the all-new VasoFlux for Men. It's a natural dietary supplement. This unique blend of barks, roots, herbs, and vitamins is nature's way of keeping you in the game. And for under $10, you can order yours today. Just visit Youth Fountain Laboratory at youthfountainlab.com. That's youthfountainlab, all one word, .com. Or call 1-800-853-7856. That's 1-800-853-7856.
Thanks for listening to the WWE Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss a show, or head to WWEPodcast.com. And for all of these shows ad-free, head over to patreon.com/WWE Podcast. Until then, we'll see you next time.